everybody, and welcome to a very special edition of LID Radio. And joining us today, I'm very excited to announce our two gentlemen, Philippe De Baca and Juan Gonzalez from Arthur D. Little, who are the authors of the great new book, Disruption, which is looking at a disruption in the banking industry and the advent of neobanks and how they are going to change the sector forever. Philippe is based in Dubai and he's joining us from there. Juan is over in Madrid, a little bit closer to home, and he is joining us from sunny Spain. Philippe and Juan, how are you two today, chaps?
Very happy to be with you today.
Happy to be here too.
It's great to see you. Now, neobanks is a term that will be unfamiliar to many people outside the fintech sector. What is the concept of a neobank, and what are they and why are they becoming popular? Juan, you can tell us a little bit more about them, please.
Yes, neobanks are all these new companies that are coming up that provide services that were provided by banks in the past. So they allow you to do payments, they allow you to get credit, they allow you to keep your track of your finances, but they have one thing in common, is they don't start the business by asking or owning a banking license. So they provide the essence of the business without going through the regulated path in the first place. So they're not banks because technically they are not regulated entities, but they provide many of the services that we associate with traditional banks.
It's an interesting point. So you're saying that actually, in the legal sense of the term, as we understand it here in Europe and here in Philippines, the Middle East, they are not banks because they don't go through the regulatory process. But presumably, to the consumer, Juan, they present and act as if they were banks.
Exactly, they act like if they were. They may decide at one stage, by the way, to get on a banking license if that suits their strategy, but they don't start with the license. They start with understanding what customers need, what technology allows, and they combine what you need and the best way to provide it to you, and they offer those services. So as I say, they offer loans, they allow you to manage your finances, they allow you to pay, that sort of things.
Philippe, what is it about them that's made them popular in the sector? What is it that the consumers like about these neobanks?
Neobanks have risen because they're capital light in terms of their model, since they're not regulated. Therefore, from an investor perspective, it is the ability to capture customers at a lower cost, hopefully, and cost of serving, which makes the entire investments more attractive. Banks, regulated banks, have capital requirements that neobanks don't have, although for some types of services and products, they still need banks, and therefore we see in many instances banks and non-banks in a hybrid model delivering certain products and services to a targeted segment.
What sort of examples are out there in the space that UK listeners in particular will have heard of, be classified as a neobank?
There are several, but most of them have moved to the traditional regulated banking model. The reason being is that banks and digital banks and neobanks are now in a fairly maturing market. 15 years ago, you would have had a flurry of banks that basically offer a credit card instead of a current account and would provide third-party products and services. As Juan mentioned, over time, they tend to migrate towards a full banking product and service suite and apply for bank licenses. So you would have historically pure digital banks, which is a variation on the theme of neobanks, the likes of Monzo, the like of Tandem Bank, etc., who basically deliver their products and services digitally without a physical branch network, but also a technology which allow them to be faster, more nimble in terms of new product introduction, and ultimately have a competitive advantage in terms of cost delivered to the client and the cost of the bank in terms of acquisition costs.
This competitive advantage. I mean, the title of your book, says it all, disruption, is that they have this competitive advantage. And because of that competitive advantage, they are disrupting the entire banking sector. Not just, as the interesting finding of the book, from a consumer perspective, in that consumers are migrating from traditional banks to neobanks, but also, Juan, in terms of investors. Investors are migrating from conventional banks to neobanks. Why?
Definitely. Well, taking a look at the performance of the banking sector in the stock market since the great financial crisis of 2008, banking sector as a whole has not recovered. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. Basically, the banks as a whole are not able to return their cost of capital to investors. So that being said, investors put the money where they think they will get the best combination of risk and return. So they find that some of these new players are able to grab new spaces and become the reference player in their category worldwide. You take Stripe, you take PayPal, you take these kind of players. They are the darlings of the investors because they are growing fast. They are capturing market share very quickly. They are becoming dominant players in their category, be it globally or locally. And therefore, they provide much higher returns. Of course, they are very risky too, because there's numbers and numbers of financial innovators that have disappeared, okay? But the value in fintech, the value in these new players tends to concentrate very heavily on the winners. And that's why the winners are getting this kind of extraordinary returns and extraordinary masses of investors. Many investors are looking for this big wins, and they put their money on a portfolio of these initiatives, and they are betting on the ones that they think that will win in the near term. And we see many examples in many different places. There are fintechs, there are successful fintechs in the United States, everybody knows about them, in Europe, but also in Latin America and in Asia. Of course, dealing with Asian customers or with Latin American customers with much smaller credit accounts or volumes requires a different model than the traditional banks were trying to deliver. So investors are betting that these guys will be able to get also the appropriate models for these new players.
Philip, you're asking to come in there.
Yes, and if you actually look now from a legacy bank perspective, they are currently trading below net tangible book, which means that strategically, if they were to acquire the premium, they would destroy shareholder value. If they were to issue additional capital, that would be exactly the same outcome. Basically, the market is saying that the future value of legacy banks is less than the current value. They are being discounted. So the real question, which also the book addresses, is what are the strategic options for legacy banks? It is not a case where legacy banks are doomed and that fintech will win. We will see winners and losers on both sides. It will be a question, as Juan highlighted, of strategy, of choices, alignment, and ability to deliver on the initial strategy.
It's a clear and present threat that traditional banks are facing. The Hightowered, the Glass and Steel, they have the brand name, but they are facing a clear and present threat from these interlopers, these disruptors, which operate in a very different way, particularly in their launch phase, to the conventional banks. Do you think, I think you're going to join us again for a separate episode about the strategy and how traditional banks may take on this threat. But I do want to ask you today, do you think that traditional banks are realistic about the threat that they face? Is there a general recognition of how dangerous the disruptors are?
There are the most progressive banks have already started to work around it. For a long time, most banks discarded these new entrants as they're not banks. They're not part of our ecosystem. It will not happen. They will only take this marginal client. So this denial type of phase, I think it's over now. It used to be the case. It used to be that banks were in denial mode. I think many of the largest and best managed banks around the world are already considering the threat as realistic and impending and immediate. They have banks have learned from disruption that has happened in other industries, in retail, in telecoms, where new entrants are really taking a very big share of the market. Okay, with new services, with new approaches, with new ways of working. So the fact that the interlopers were not banks, which used to be a defense, is no longer a defense. I think best run banks already realized the threat and are taking steps to benefit from the changes, as Philippe always mentions. It's not that banks will lose and interlopers will win. It's that we believe that there will be a combination hybridization, name you want as you wish, of ways to get out of this situation where we are today.
To what extent do you think, Philippe, that although their denial phase has passed, there is still an inertia phase, perhaps not of the fault of the conventional banks themselves? And the reason I ask it is, I'm talking here from a British perspective, I suspect the truth is similar in other territories and jurisdictions, but certainly in Britain, many, many customers of traditional banks don't ever visit a bank branch. I'm one of them. I don't think I remember the last time I've been to a bank branch. Many people my age and younger don't ever go there. But if a bank tries to close a bank branch on the high street in a British town or city, there is uproar from the public. It is unpopular. And actually, we know the business reality is that it costs the banks an exceptional amount of money to run these premises. And presumably the returns on them running these premises are rather low. So my question to you, Philippe, is that even if they are no longer denying it, and one says that phase is pretty much over, but certainly for the bigger and more sensible institutions, to what extent are they hooked to the old models, perhaps not their own behest, but at the behest of their customer base?
Well, first of all, the fact that you no longer visit the branch means that legacy banks, traditional high street banks, have closed the gap on customer experience and some of the key features that historically were technology driven by new entrants and fintech. The distribution model has evolved from multiple distribution channels. That is, you know, you have the branch network and then you have internet based and digital crept in, to omni-distribution, trying to converge physical branches and digital. And we will see two things. One, inevitably, a reduction in the retail footprint of high street banks. It's inevitable. It has to be done in the right way. And today, it's a bit considered as an expensive bulletin board, if you will, on high streets. But also for some types of products, the regulator still requires some in-person process, particularly if, for instance, an insurance product is linked to a mortgage, et cetera. But there are some clear examples in different parts of the world where the multi-distribution, omni-distribution, and third-party services combined into one product and services can really create a competitive advantage. And Commonwealth Bank in Australia, for instance, would be one of these examples. So again, it is not the end necessarily of all branches. It certainly will be a different purpose for the branch and an integrated channel.
Let's take a step back and think not only in terms of banks, but think about high street retail more globally, okay? So we've seen a transformation of high street retail everywhere in the world. A migration towards other formats, a combination with online and offline. The role of stores in for different businesses has changed. So banks, in that sense, are no different from any other shopkeeper who has the shop open on the main street. People go in or not. People decide to buy there or in other places. People get information. People compare. So I think this is a broad transformation that is not specific only to banks, but to the way we shop, the way we buy in our daily behavior.
Philippe.
The real challenge is that the role of the branch is changing. In the past, the branch used to be the sales channel where products and services were advised typically by the branch manager. Because of consumer behavior and the lack of trust that now people have in banks as opposed to non-banks, the purchase decision, be it on an asset or liability product, is taken outside of the branch. By asking the community, going into the blog and chat rooms, etc., and the investor or client is making his decision outside, and therefore the branches have become a very expensive fulfillment center for some certain parts of the process or certain types of products. So this is the real challenge for banks.
It's a huge challenge for banks. And of course, crucially, it's a challenge that neobanks, by and large, don't have because they don't have branches and they don't have the pressure to have branches because they never have had branches. So the fact that one has had branches in the past, presumably, is a huge negative drag on the business model.
It is. The neobanks have two advantages, three advantages, I would say. As Philippe mentioned, people, I mean, especially young consumers, trust neobanks more than they trust banks. And trust is essential to the banking business, okay? Because it's either who I'm going to lend my money to or who I'm going to ask money from. It's trust is essential to the business. Neobanks have the trust advantage. Neobanks have the data advantage. They have been built around understanding the customers, knowing their behavior. They build on that. The third one, neobanks have this cost advantage. They are not dragged with unessential assets. So what was essential in the past, and there used to be a strong correlation between your the number of branches you had and the market share you had. So in the past, owning branches was essential to perform. It's becoming now a liability. And things change. But again, as I say, it's the same thing that is going on in many other retail forms. Customers choose. They decide if they go to the branch to buy or they only get to get advice or they only go to complain, which is even worse. Mm. So you might have your most expensive channel for the least valuable interaction with the customer, which is those complaints. It's really learning to live with your existing asset base, which is relevant. You cannot dispose of it. Building the new ones and then transforming. And of course, yes, there's a lot of public relations. You need to work to make people understand, to make your customers understand that you're going to be better served without branches than you are with branches. I think there's a lot of effort that needs to be put in that process too.
And that's the huge paradox of banking. And we may just magnify that and amplify that point that Juan's made is that what we're seeing now for the legacy banking sector, its most expensive assets are delivering its least profitable services. And in some cases, its loss-making services, its complaints procedures, its small level deposits, and generally liaising with a smaller and smaller demographic of the population. There are things that can be done, and we're going to find out more about those. We're going to leave it on a little bit of a cliffhanger here in this episode. We're going to find a bit more about what can be done and the strategy for delivering success in our next episode of Lid Radio, when we're going to be joined again by Philippe and Juan, who are going to tell us a little bit about how we get out of this cycle and how we turn disruption into success. But for today, I'll say, Philippe, thank you very much. And Juan, thank you very much for your time. And we'll join you again on Lid Radio very soon indeed.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you.